we're in a very noisy pub, and this pub is home to part of Brighton and Hove Grown. And I'm going to say the words cranberry juice, thank you, as someone buys me a drink. But I'm also going to talk to David
Spillman.
And David, I've just seen a little bit of the Anterbury Towers, and so I'm going to start with a bit of a stinker of a question, if you don't mind. Would you say that the really impressive verse that we just heard and saw performed by you is a fairly good modern equivalent of what Middle English, Medieval English was for the Canterbury Tales? Do you think you're doing the modern version of that?
Sort of. what I've actually done, my background is literature, and so when I had this idea of writing the Anterbury Tales, well, 5 years ago, I've actually finished writing the tales now, but it's been a long process. The first thing I did is I read Chaucer, basically, or at least I read the Canterbury Tales. And what I wanted to do was get as much as possible, I wanted to get a feel, a flavour, you know, a sense of what it felt like. You know, and it's in Middle English, so if you think that Shakespeare is still counted as early modern English, it's not familiar to, you know, to the modern ear. But it's like anything, you get your ear in, you get your eye in, and then it becomes easier to read and to digest and to get that kind of rhythm and so on.
Yeah.
And so when the prologue is unusual because it's in verse, and you know that's deliberately the case because I want to give people, I don't just want to set up the story, I want to try and give people a flavour of Chaucer, a feel of Chaucer. And so what I tried to do was reproduce that in some way. So you know, there were certain words that I use, such as the ant quod this, or he refers to the earwig's japes. So I used some of the older words that don't get used very much these days as well. And Chaucer, actually, when he did the Canterbury Tales, wrote a general prologue where he introduces each character blow by blow. And so essentially that's what I wanted to do here is introduce this cast of about a dozen characters who are all storytellers within the stories. And then in the book that I've written, of course, you've got all 12 stories. Whereas here in the show, we then fast forward to certain selected tales. And the 50-minute show will feature two of those 12 tales.
But also the shock of my encounter at school with the Canterbury Tales was, you know, with Chanticleer and Pertolote. This was 18 certificate stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a reason why Chaucer tends to be an A-level text rather than appearing before then. You know, and you take something like The Miller's Tale and you've got Red Hot Pokers Meet Bottoms and that sort of thing. You've got, you know, and Chaucer's very interesting because it divides into a great number of categories. So you've got the Knight's Tale, which is, you know, it's courtesy, chivalry, personified or squared, you know, these very kind of courtly tales. And on the other hand, you've got things like the Miller's Tale and the Reeve's Tale. You've got the Cook's Tale, where the cook's so drunk he falls off the horse and can't even finish his story. So you've got this kind of, you know, one of the things that was amazing about the Canterbury Tales was that Chaucer had this incredible range where he had, you know, he had knights, he had squires, he had these kind of very earthy characters. He had good priests and bad priests, effectively. Yeah, this great range of things. And so, yeah, so Chaucer, in writing Chaucer for kids, as a, obviously, I had to look at the bawdy humour and change that. But what I did do is, some stories are dramatic, some stories are fables. There's fairy tale, there's myth,
and there are insects,
and insects in the broadest sense. So, you know, there's a word that gets used in primary schools now, mini beasts, and I hate that word. I really hate it. But of course, strictly speaking, it's more than insects because you've got, you've got spiders, you've got slugs, you know, and centipedes and so on feature as well.
So we've got, that's the content, and we've got some chosen stories here that you've rendered and adapted.
That's
and
right.
I absolutely, even from the way that you're dressed now, we can be in no doubt that you're respecting and rendering, you know, Chaucer. But also in the delivery of it tonight and the way you were moving, you know, and I enjoyed this, you know, you could have been at a poetry slam. And so there's something in that that's very modern about the way you're delivering. That's not Chaucer. That's you know, I could have been at Poetry Slam, and there you were delivering in that way.
Yeah, the, I mean, the idea was to give comic poetry in couplets, and to just give it need. You know, I thought about doing the prologue in various ways, but it needed to be in verse because it gives that flavour, and so. That the challenge was there were several things I was trying to do at once. One was I was trying to be faithful and accurate with the actual insects. So, for example, I contacted the Natural History Museum about a very tiny beetle called the Capra beetle because I needed to get a key detail right. Or I visited an apiary in order to get my stories involving bees, beehives and wasps right, for example. So on the one hand, there was that. Then there was trying to give something that just had this feel. So I wanted to have a classical feel, but you know, without making the language too difficult. So having kind of modern stories, and what I haven't done is simply, for example, retold the knight's tale and just turned the knight into a knight. So there is a knight's tale, but it's a completely different tale in that it's a knight who's trying to recover an emerald necklace for damselflies. You've got a damselfly in distress. You've got dragonflies, you know, as the enemies and so on, so it's not just a retelling of the story. It's really a reimagining or a reworking of Chaucer, but trying to kind of stay faithful to what I'd felt and heard, and do you know what I mean? A flavour of the original. Trying to stay faithful to that, but still write something fresh or original or interesting.
In terms of the actual performance style, here you are in costume, but you can listen, actually, go into a slightly different myth, which is around Lord of the Rings. But what survived of Tolkien actually reading his own work is it's clearly storytelling, and it's very much spoken word. But there have been versions by the BBC that take it into drama and take it into the theatre, and it's bigged up and it's characterised. And I've heard similar with, you know, and seen readings of Chaucer that are done, all, I would say, almost monotone. They're sort of very laid-back storytelling because the words and the story almost tells itself. But I've seen other people really go into the, well, they're in the theatre world. Now, what I saw on the stage is you are combining spoken word, and you are bigging it up a bit into theatre, aren't you?
A little bit. I mean, yes. The prologue is slightly different from the rest in that it is obviously it's fixed in terms of the actual poetry, the rhythm, and so on, and trying to give that sense of rhythm, but make it a comic or dramatic performance. And then with the stories themselves, it's much more of a storytelling thing. So, for example, I took the Golem myth, which is a Jewish story where, in I think it was the 16th, 17th century in Prague, and I'm half Czech, so a Jewish Czech story, I'm also Jewish, is kind of really my roots.
And that's quite a dark tale, isn't it?
Well, it is, in that the original Golem story, the Golem was created out of clay to protect the Jewish community from accusations essentially of child murdering and that sort of thing. And this, you know, this is a community. In my story, it's the Ladybird's Tower, and the Ladybird community are in fear because they're being accused of arson in a forest. That's a serious thing, you know. And so they create this golem out of leaves and so on to find the real culprit. But even when he does, there's this issue of him being an outsider, and they start to distrust him, and he becomes a scapegoat for all sorts of things, and it becomes an issue of whether he needs to be destroyed or not. So, I mean, there's some humour in that story, for example, but it's not a laugh a minute knockabout story for kids. It's a, you know, it's a drama because there are some serious issues that come up in that.
Now, wearing for me a director's hat, The content of what I heard is very clever. It's really well crafted. In terms of the delivery, there is a rhythm and there is a meter, and it's really pacey. Is that a choice that you've made to really let this, you know, move along at a quick pace? You don't slow, you don't stop, you don't, you know, have a few seconds of pauses. That's why I was saying spoken word. This is really motoring along.
Well, it is. I guess it's something as well that if you work on something like this for long periods of time, I found myself just cutting out, I think, a lot of what I felt was unnecessary and trying to get to the nub. So I thought, okay, in this prologue, I need to set the scene, introduce the characters and then introduce the actual narrative, you know, the turns of the story, as in everyone tells a story one at a time, people don't interrupt, and so forth. So that's quite a lot to fit in. And to be honest, I don't like descriptions. So when I, you know, as a kind of, I don't know, I call myself an amateur writer or whatever, but, you know, I've always loved creative writing. But as a writer, I don't like description. So I try to be sparing with how I use it and pick key moments or key things that give an image. I think as a writer, perhaps Graham Greene has really influenced me. So you take something like the opening of The Power and the Glory, and what you're reading is virtually cinematic. You can see this thing happening and playing out before you, and the details that are there are all there to build this atmosphere, you know, and so I've tried to do something a bit like that in using detail that helps. So, for example, I've got 12 characters, but I've allowed myself only one verse for each character. So I've got four lines to introduce, you know, the bumblebee, and to show that he's kind of jolly and seems to be superficial. And again, that's actually the narrator's completely wrong here, because the bumblebee actually tells the most, you know, the most profound story of all, and you know, which is, you know, he's dismissed as this kind of chubby football fan, basically, you know, very kind of jolly character, and he's, that's really not who he is. So sometimes it's to set up a character, sometimes it's to knock them down. So you've got the Earwig, who's desperate to tell his story about his exploits, and effectively Earwig thinks he's Sinbad, and so he you know, he meets a giant bird. He's going in his story he's going on a quest. There's a kind of a huge egg that he tries to escape in. He meets ants firing acid at him. There's treasure. You know, it's this tall tale, the kind of that you'd get in a kind of Sinbad type Arabian Nights story. But immediately there's also this question that's in there, because, you know, so I say, keen for his exploits to be told, although he didn't look that old, you know, where he's got this kind of series of eight or nine stories, and people look at him thinking, really, you know, you can't have done this, you haven't been around long enough. And so there's this kind of little question mark placed against the Earwig straight away. But the challenge for me was to only have to limit myself to four lines to introduce every character in a way that made them seem real.
Two final questions. First, to the performer, how do you make sure that the next time you do it feels like the first time you do it?
Just forget my lines. That's a good question. It's something I need to remind myself about. And, you know, a key thing I found when I, the first time I did this, I was kind of, it was strange. My wife was actually watching, and she said to me afterwards, do you realise you were looking at the adults rather than at the kids when I was sort of performing? I guess for, you know, to try and get a bit of encouragement or something, you know, while I was nervous. And so I think a key thing is to remind myself it's fresh, and to perform to who's there. And also, with the prologue, there's lots of, while it's set verse, there's different ways of performing the lines. You know, it's like anything, isn't it? When you can perform Shakespeare, but you could do the lines differently each time. And then with the stories, because it's storytelling, it's not fixed, you know, the exact words. And so there is a certain amount of, for example, in my spare times, or in real life, I've been an EFL teacher. And one of the things I've found is that my best times in the classroom have been when I've kind of had a vague idea of what I've wanted to do rather than a clear idea, because then that allows me to be creative in the classroom. And I think going in with that ability to be creative and to let things change according to the audience, according to the mood or whatever, is a good way to keep it fresh.
So, final question. It's a bit of an impossible one, but that makes it fun. Geoffrey Chaucer comes to see the Anterbury Tales. What do you think he'd make of it?
Oh, he'd love it. I put it on my flyer, so he must do. No, I mean,
what makes you say that?
No, maybe he would get what I'm trying to do. In the sense that there's an awful lot of Chaucer in the stories in all sorts of ways. For example, Chaucer has one character who, the squire, tells this elaborate story, and actually he only gets to the beginning and then gets cut off, because otherwise he'd have talked longer than the knight or anyone else. And so I had the caterpillar telling effectively a Lord of the Rings type stat tale, and he tells a short story, and it's all build up, and it's clear that he would have talked for the next 2 days if he was allowed. And so the other characters kind of jump in, you know, the Bumblebee says good game, and they kind of applaud him off the stage effectively, and the caterpillar's like, but I haven't finished, and so the caterpillar is a kind of a nod to the squire. Similarly, the reason I did the ladybird story about the golem was actually a riposte to the prioress's tale, which is actually an anti-Semitic story of the kind of Jews as the bogeyman and so on. Or the other one that amuses me is the narrator actually tells two of the stories in Chaucer are actually told by the narrator himself, technically Geoffrey Chaucer. And so I've got a narrator, and he gets asked to tell two stories, and like the narrator, the first story is actually cut off halfway. And in Chaucer, he's telling a story, and the host, Harry Bailey, cuts him off because he basically says, your rhyming is crap, it's not worth a turd, it's total rubbish, and tells him to tell a prose story instead. So what I did is I thought, well, okay, let's make the rhyming as ludicrous as possible. So I called the story The Tale of Adventure, which is just the most ridiculous title I could think of. And basically, it was a Western in Limerick. And so every verse was a limerick. And halfway through, the aunt, who's the kind of the host of this, is kind of, you know, he's got his both sets of hands covering his ears, and he's just like, stop, I can't take anymore. You know, your rhyming is not worth a turd. And so my character narrator says, okay, and he gets told to tell another character. So he tells a story called Dung and Diamonds, which is basically about the value of turds. And so in that sense, if you took Chaucer and he read it, he would see the references and he would see the nods. So hopefully he would not think it's worth a turd. Or if he did, at least a turd of reasonable value.
A very different show for all the family. Thanks very much for talking to Fringe Review.
Thank you, Paul.